This is Rick Kirkman, co-creator of the syndicated comic strip Baby Blues, and you're watching Mr. Media.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Keith Dallas, editor of an ambitious new history project from Tomorrow's Publishing titled American Comic Book Chronicles. The first volume, covering 1960 to 1964, is out, and it's a gem. Stick around, and don't get too mad at your show host, who may have trouble asking questions because he's so engrossed in all the four-color goodness. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview. The show is brought to you today by Amazon.com, the world's greatest store for everything from books and movies to computers, TVs, and even my favorite soft drink, Pepsi Wild Cherry. Thinking about buying something online from Amazon or just want to do a little window shopping? You can save yourself a lot of money and help support Mr. Media, that's me, by clicking on one of the Amazon ads at MrMedia.com and start your shopping with us. Get yourself the new iPad or Kindle Fire. Feeling a little racy today? Amazon's got what you need to feel exciting and new, as they used to sing on The Love Boat. Remember, start your next shopping trip from the comfort of your own home, car, hotel, or office with Amazon.com at MrMedia.com. That's right, MrMedia.com. And folks, thanks for your support. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of fanboys who think they know it all about Charlton, Dell, Gold Key, ACG, and Harvey comic books, but won't until they actually read the complete set of American Comic Book Chronicles in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. It's no secret that I'm a lifetime comic book fan. I can trace my love of the form, comics that is, women were a few years later, back to the mid-1960s when my grandfather and I were on our way back to catch a suburban bus back to New Brunswick, New Jersey, from the Port Authority in Manhattan, of course, and we stopped at a newsstand. He wanted a New York Daily News, and he pointed me towards the comic book section so I could read something on the ride home, too, just like an adult. And my eyes went right to the latest issue of the X-Men. I knew nothing about them yet, but they looked so cool. And I remember that moment of discovery like no other. There were other opportunities to read piles of comics in the years that followed. My cousin Fred Sorotkin, who lived in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, his entire basement was given over to his alphabetized collection of what I recall to be mostly Archies. And my older male cousins on my father's side, Mark and Scott Shoham, always had a stack of Marvel and DC superheroes in the basement of their Bloomfield, Connecticut house to divert me from their more mature teen pursuits whenever we visited. Now, in the 1970s, I built my own substantial collection of thousands of comics, less for their collectible value and more for the sheer joy of reading and rereading. My first paid writing assignment, in fact, at age 13, was about the growing popularity of comics, produced for a Midwest hobbyist newspaper. And I wrote dozens more stories, paid and unpaid, about comics throughout high school, developing a style and a speed at a very young age. All of which is my way of saying that when I first heard about the first volume of Tomorrow's Publishing's new series, American Comic Book Chronicles, I had to see it. Now, curiously, the book starts off with the years 1960 to 64, skipping almost 30 years of history that came before. And, you know, to be honest, that's fine with me. I was born in 1960. Did anything really exist before me? I find that hard to believe. Now, Volume 1, written by John Wells and edited by my guest today, Keith Dallas, that's him hiding behind the book, is packed with industry anecdotes and behind-the-scenes tales of not just the birth of the Marvel Age and the rebirth of DC Comics, but it also tells many stories I hadn't read before involving lesser publishers such as Charlton, Dell, Gold Key, Harvey, and ACG. Those are important because they employed so many creators, such as Steve Ditko and Neil Adams, who went on to be huge influences on the decades to come. All right, I know what you're thinking. Enough of me. Let's talk comics. Keith Dallas, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for holding the book up.
Yeah.
See any typos?
I did find a few that John and I mean, what's amazing is I mean, I can't tell you how many times this book was copy edited and proofread. I mean, not only, you know, I did it several times, John did it several times, and then it goes to print, and sure enough, you still find, you know, typos and, you know, italization errors and things like that. And it just, I mean, that's just stuff you just got to grin and bear it and just say you hope you did the best you could at finding stuff.
You know what, Keith? I've got 16 books out under my byline at this point, and it shocks me how many times I'll open one for research or some other reason, and your eye goes right to the typo, right to the mistake, and you go, ugh!
You go, how in the world did I miss that the first four times I read this book?
Oh, my God. And I know, you know, every book I've worked on, I've had really good copy editors, and stuff just gets by. Somehow it gets by. Anyway. Well, so look. Let's start this conversation for real by talking about and dealing with the elephant in the room. Did okay. Nothing really happen in American comics before 1960?
Well, you know, it's, you ask a sort of common question of, you know, well, okay, why are you starting with this volume? And one of my responses is always, well, we actually were supposed to start with the 1980s volume, because that was... That was what I pitched to John Morrow, was a year-by-year account of the comic book industry during the 1980s, which he loved. But he said, he didn't want to just publish a book about the 1980s. He wanted to publish a book about every single decade in comic book history. I said, okay, well, that's not something that I could write. I was born in 69, so about 10 years younger than you are.
Oh yeah, rub it in. Thank you. Interview over. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
The 1980s was essentially my years of nostalgia. So he had some ideas about, you know, who could write which volumes, and I had some ideas as well. And, you know, John Wells, I tapped on to write the 1960s volumes. And the reason why his volume was published first is because he's the one who finished it first. You know, it really comes down to practicality, that he was able to finish his book first. And the other authors, you know, Roy Thomas is writing the volumes on the 1940s, and he's busy with other projects right now. Hmm. So the 1940s volumes are actually going to be published last.
So it's a mistake for me to refer to it as volume one, because it's not. It's just they're just coming out as they're finished. They're not coming out.
Exactly.
You guys didn't decide, you and John Morrow didn't decide that comic books began in the 60s and nothing else mattered.
No. I mean, there might have been some discussion about, which volumes or which decades would sell better than others, but I think we presume that, you know, as a series, they're all going to sell relatively the same. I mean, maybe like the 1990s volume doesn't sell as well as the 1960s volume, because maybe, we haven't hit that 1990s nostalgia yet. And also, you know, the sort of typical tomorrow's reading audience is more focused on the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And, you know, with Alter Ego, you have, you know, readers of... interested in the 40s, but you're correct. This really isn't volume one. It's just the first volume that that has been printed.
Well, all due respect to Roy, who I like and have communicated with over the years, and actually interviewed for my Will Eisner biography years ago. I'm just going to stick with the fact that that this is the first volume, and nothing that happened before 1960 mattered, because I wasn't born yet.
Okay. All right. We'll make sure to include that.
I'm going to take a very Sheldon-like attitude from Big Bang Theory. That yeah. if it happens.
Well, I am interested to know. I mean, I've gone through, you know, some message boards, and I mean, and there are some people who are flat out, you know, there are some people who say they're going to buy every volume, and there are some people who say, well, they have absolutely zero interest in the 1970s. So they're going to skip that, but they are going to read the 60s, and they are going to read the 80s. I mean, it's obviously a very subjective type of preference, you know.
Well, so. One of the things I'm curious about is, I mean, as someone who's been a fan of comics for, well, let's just say that I got that first X-Men comic, it was probably 64, 65.
Okay.
I honestly, I can't remember what year the X-Men started. Was it later than that? Was it earlier than that?
No. It was 63.
Okay.
Sure it was 63.
All right. I knew it wasn't the first one. I knew it was, but it was, you know, probably under, in the first 10, maybe. You know, having grown up the way I did and when I did, I've read a ton of comic book history. I don't have all my comics that I collected when I was a kid. I sold those to go to college, frankly. But, you know, I've bought some over the years. I used to buy some and share them with my daughter, who's now a teenager. And I, you know, picked up over the years comic book histories here and there. Comics, because of the nature of comics fans, and there's fanzines, and there have been tens of thousands of fanzines over the years, the history of comics has been extremely well documented. So where I'm going with this long and winding question is, why do we need a bound set of comic book histories? Doesn't all this information already exist out there?
Yeah, it does. I mean, and if you look at the Works Cited section of the 1960s volume, you'll see that, you know, John references, you know, a whole plethora of, I mean, that Works Cited section in and of itself is, you know, 6 to 8 pages. So he's, you know, he's citing tons and tons of articles and books and interviews. I would say that the uniqueness of American Comic Book Chronicles is that it's a very thorough year-by-year account that's not presented as an encyclopedia. It's presented as a narrative. So that's, you know, when we collected all the writers, that was one of the first things I told them. I said, you know, you're not writing an encyclopedia. Think of it, you're writing a history novel. So you're documenting comic book history as it unfolded. And, I mean, John Wells, who's an incredible, he's not only an incredible writer, but just incredibly knowledgeable about every decade of comic book history. He was able to get that down pat. He was able to, okay, it's a narrative, and, you know, and he confessed to me that he had some challenges in presenting it as a story, but, you know, but some other authors, I could see they're struggling with it. I mean, they're, you know, they can present the facts, but trying to sort of massage it into a narrative has been, and I'll confess that was, you know, one of my principal challenges writing the 1980s volume, was always keeping in mind that this is a narrative. This is a story. This is meant to, you know, engage the reader. It's not just a collection of facts. Mm. To answer your question in another way, I would say that, you know, a lot of the books that have come out, say like Sean Howe's book. Have you read Sean Howe's book about Marvel?
No.
I highly recommend it. It's an excellent documentation of the history of Marvel Comics. But it's just about Marvel Comics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing to note about comic book history is that these publishers are all influencing each other. So what Marvel is publishing is in reaction to what DC is publishing, which is in reaction to what Dell was publishing, which was, you know, and they're all influencing each other. They're, you know, and not saying that they're all imitating each other, but they all, you know, are, you know, reacting to each other. And then that's true of any decade in comic book history. So these books strive to give you the entire landscape of comic book history, not just DC, not just Marvel, not just, you know, you know, I think, you know, again, this is not to say that this book is better than every single history book, every single, you know, comic book history book that's come out before. That's definitely not the case. But I think people will see that it's, you know, it's not like any other history book that's been, you know, comic book history book that's been published before.
Yeah, I really liked it. I think John Wells, who wrote this, I think he did a really good job of. Because, look, I'll be honest, I was prepared not to like it. When I heard about it, I was prepared not to like it when I opened it up because I thought, okay well, the art looks great. I mean, it's a, and I'm going to ask you about the art in a minute, but there's a great selection of promotional pages, and there's some original art pages, and it's just a great landscape of different things that you could collect to show the era. But I was very prepared not to like the writing because I thought, well, this may be very staid and it may be very flat. But it's not. It's great. There's great anecdotes. There's great behind-the-scenes stuff. There's stuff, you know, I feel like I'm pretty well read on the history of Marvel and DC from the 60s and 70s because that's when I grew up. That's what I was interested in. I read it a lot and I've read it back and I've interviewed a lot of people now myself. So, you know, what really grabbed me, what I didn't know as much about was the smaller publishers. And I kind of alluded to that in the introduction. I love Charlton Comics mostly because not everybody read them. So I felt a little like I had a little exclusivity when you could find them somewhere and read them. So I liked that. And I never couldn't find Dell and Gold Key very much. So like I was in my 20s before I really knew anything about Magnus Robot Fighter or, you know, Turok, Son of Stone, stuff like that. And so, you know, that was something I was late coming to. And so it's really interesting to read the stories and some of the politics and the business decisions. And what I love, there's a great explanation in there about how the comics publishers in the early 60s certainly, for the most part, really had no idea how many books they were selling because of the bizarreness of the distribution system. And John doesn't even really, that I recall, doesn't even get into the fact that so much of the distribution of comics and magazines was mob-controlled, so nobody really knew what the hell was going on.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, that definitely comes into play in the 70s and 80s, you know, particularly, Jim Shooter. When I spoke to Jim Shooter while I was writing the 80s book, you know, he told me that not that the circulation numbers were made up, but like you said, you know, it was mob controlled and everything was on an honor system. And, you know, for your viewers who are not, you know, familiar with how it works, for the way it worked with the newsstand, you know, a publisher would, you know, say, okay, you know, this issue of Avengers is coming out, and each of the individual newsstand distributors would say, okay, we want this many copies, we want that many copies. So let's say one distributor says, okay, we want 1,000 copies of the latest issue of Avengers. So Marvel sends them 1,000 copies of the latest issue of Avengers. Now, the newsstand, obviously, this newsstand distributor is not just distributing Marvel Comics, you know, it's distributing, you know, Time Magazine and Newsweek and Reader's Digest and TV Guide. All these magazines not only sell more copies, but also make a better profit both for the distributor and for the actual, you know, newsstand operator. So a lot of times, and Dick Giordano, you know, said this in several places, that a lot of times these comic books that got sent to the distributors never even made it on the truck because it's squeezed out by the higher priced magazines. So now, because the standard was affidavit returns, that's the way the newsstand works, is whatever it doesn't sell, it gets to return for a refund, but they don't actually return. I mean, Marvel doesn't need unsold copies of Avengers, so it's all based on an honor system. They say, okay, well, we ordered 1,000 copies, but we only sold 300 copies. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you know, they probably only distributed 400 copies. So if they sold 300 copies out of 400 copies, that's actually a really good return. That's a really good sell-through rate. But really, it's 300 copies out of the 1,000 that they ordered. That's a pretty bad sell-through rate.
Right.
Now, meanwhile, if they actually sold 300 copies, they wouldn't say they sold 300 copies. They would say they sold, you know, 150 copies or 200 copies, because who's going to dispute that?
Right.
So go ahead.
They're keeping that extra money, and bearing in mind, at the time this book takes place, 60 to 64, comic books went up from a dime to 12 cents. And it basically, I think it was like a 50-50 split, wasn't it? A nickel to the publisher and a nickel to the...
That sounds right. I have to go back and look in John's book and see if he provides that. But yeah, I mean, it's... Which, and John does, really thorough job of explaining how... was it Dell that tried to raise it to 15?
Right.
And the readers essentially revolted. You know, and when we say, wow, big deal, went from a dime to 15 cents. But in the early 60s. Now, you know, that's 50 years ago. That was
sure. Rub it in.
So,
what a revolting development. Never mind.
Well, you know, I guess to put it into contemporary, you know, terms, think about the uproar when DC and Marvel raised it from, you know, $2.99 to $3.99, you know, and how, you know, I mean, so this was essentially the same thing that, you know, you didn't have that much discretionary funds, and that made a huge difference to go from a dime to 15 cents.
Yeah.
So,
well, let me change gears on you a little bit and ask you about the art in this book.
Sure.
There's great stuff. What's kind of the philosophy, not just to this book, to the whole series, in terms of what art you want to use and, you know, what gets chosen and what does not?
You know, I mean, going back to your comment about, okay, well, we've had so many of these comic book history books, and you know, what do they show? I mean, there's certain, you know, iconic covers, you know, the cover to Avengers number one and things like that. And so that we did feel obligated to, you know, show the really iconic covers. But, I mean, you know, something that John Wells and I discussed and something that we discussed with the other authors is that when people buy, say, like the archive editions or those, you know, Marvel Masterworks, they obviously get the covers. Mm-hmm. But what they don't get are they don't get, like, the letter columns. They don't get the promo ads, which would be really cool if Marvel or DC or wherever, you know, could reprint those. Because that I think that's, you know, revealing in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's something that John and I, you know, agreed upon and stressed to the other authors is that as much as possible, show the house ads, you know, show the letter columns, show, you know, things that, you know, things in fanzines and, you know, things in like Comics Buyer's Guide or Amazing Heroes, you know, going into, you know, into my decade, because those are most likely things that the reader will have never seen, you know, or at least more than not have not seen. You know, everyone has seen the cover to Avengers number one. And again, it would be Fantastic Four number one or whatever, you know, but, and that has to get placed. But what about the house ad that was promoting Fantastic Four number one? Has, you know, how many people have seen that? Well, and again, you can't find that in the Marvel Masterworks, you know, volume, that what reprints Fantastic Four 1 through 10, because they're not going to have that. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the general, you know, marching order was as much as, you know, obviously include as much of the iconic material as possible, but also include material that the reader most likely has never seen.
In the books from the early 70s, will we see art from Foom and, you know, Friends of Old Marvel and stuff like that?
If we can find it, you know, I'll have to talk to Jim Beard is the lead author of the 1970s volume, so I'll have to. You know, I haven't actually kept tabs on him on what images he's collating. So,
that was I love the stuff that they produced for. That was the, for people who don't know, it was the Marvel, the in-house fan club that they had. It was Friends of Old Marvel, one of those Stan Lee creations, I assume, and they called it Foom, and it was great, just great stuff that was not in the comics, and then also, yep, in the late 60s, and I still have some of these. All the psychedelic black light art stuff. The pop art stuff, the Marvel greeting cards, and all that kind of stuff. The black velvet Marvel stuff.
Yeah, that we might have just because, you know, a lot of it was Kirby stuff. A lot of it they just took, you know, and as you may know, John Morrow is you know, one of the premier Jack Kirby historians. Mm-hmm. So that stuff that I'm pretty sure that we'll have access to. John Wells is, you know, currently composing the second 60s volume, so I'm sure he's included. Yeah.
Well, and speaking of John, I wanted to ask you, the way these books are produced, it seems like it must be a huge commitment of resources by John. And normally, you know, when I talk to someone about a comics project, whether it's comics or history, I don't talk about the publisher, but in this case, am I wrong? I mean, volume one, I'm going to hold up the book. I usually don't hold up the book, but I mean, it's let me see. There's the binding. It's perfect bound. It's square bound. It's a hardcover book, whereas a lot of these comics type books, you know, more recently, they tend to be soft bound because it's less expensive. And it's full color throughout. I mean, this is a huge commitment of resources, unless I'm mistaken.
And the 80s book is actually thicker. The 80s book is about 60 pages thicker than this first, you know, 60s volume.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, we, you know, I'm glad John Morrow, you know, took this route. You know, I think, and it's something that he decided on his own. It's not something that I had to sell him on. You know, it was something that he, because if you remember, Tomorrow's put out like those DC companion books, mm-hmm. you know, like the All Companion, and I mean, I did the Flash Companion, and those were soft cover, and those were black and white pages. And this is something that, you know, when I pitched my idea, and then it got expanded to covering every single decade, it was something that he, you know, very quickly said, okay, we're going to do this hardcover, we're going to do it full color, and we'll see, you know, what price point we have to, you know, make it in order to, you know, to sell it. So, you know, I could see, you know, some people might go to Amazon and say, wow, you know, this is a, you know, $40 book, $50 book, but, you know, hopefully if, you know, on the website itself, you can access previews, you know, many, many pages previewed on the website, and hopefully just flipping through it and reading passages, you know, people will feel it's worth the money.
Well, let me be the first to say, or the latest to say, it's worth the money. If you're a comics fan, I mean, you'll be very happy, certainly with this first book, this first one I've seen. You'll be very happy to read it, enjoy it, show off the art. The art is so cool, especially the promo pages, the original art pages. It's just some really cool stuff that you can probably find it out there if you really want to look and look and look. But here it all, it's collected in one place, and it's going to be cool to have on your shelf and, you know, show your friends and, you know.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I'm very impressed with it. So when will we see the next volume?
The 80s volume is en route from the printer, so that should be here in mid-April. I want to say mid-April, maybe late April, depending on if there's any, you know, holdups with customs. Mm-hmm. I am currently copy editing the 1950s volume, which was written by Bill Shelley, and that's really, you know, I mean, that's particularly a decade that I knew very little about. And it's really, really fascinating what Bill has written, particularly about EC Comics. I mean, I after reading Bill's sections about EC Comics, I want to go out and buy those EC archives, you know, with the Harvey Kurtzman art and the Wally Wood art. And so that the 1950s volume is, we'll have that in time for San Diego Comic-Con.
Cool. Summer. Great.
So that I know we'll have copies on hand at San Diego, so that'll probably be in stores in August. So 1980s volume in April, 1950s volume in August, and then it's a race to see if John Wells can finish his second 60s volume before Jim Beard can finish his 1970s volume. Mm.
So they're happening. They're coming. They're all in they're in various stages. That's great. Yeah. That's great. And I should point out here that Bill Shelley has been on this show. I'll try to remember to put the link to that at the bottom of this interview. And I'm trying to remember, did he do the book on Joe Kubert or on Bill Malden?
Yeah. Joe Kubert.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I just couldn't remember. I have to think to remember who did the Malden book. It was for, I want to say it was for Fantagraphics. I'll figure it out. Anyway, so listen, folks, before we run out of time completely, you can find American Comic Book Chronicles, 1960 to 64. And remember, nothing before that matters because I wasn't born yet. It's in great stores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. If you're watching the video, just look a little further down the page, down there, and you should be able to see the cover of the book, and you can just click on it. It'll take you right to Amazon. You'll get the best price there you possibly can, and order it. I promise you will not be disappointed. Keith, is there a website or a Twitter, Facebook, any of that kind of stuff for the series?
Not for the series. I mean, it would be on tomorrows.com would be where you could find, you know, more information. Like I said, it's right there on the website, you know, the previews of the book.
All right. Well, I'm going to jump in here and tell you that one of you guys needs to create a Facebook page for the series so fans can come in and discuss it and talk about it and generate interest.
That's actually an excellent idea.
You know how it is. If you're not on Facebook, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Kind of like anything that happened before 1960. That's the way I look at it.
Great idea.
All right. And Keith, are you you on Facebook or Twitter or anything yourself?
Yep. On Facebook, you know, just Keith Dallas, you know. There's actually a Keith Dallas, an actor in Hollywood. And you won't confuse him for me because he's this huge black dude. Okay. So if you find a Keith Dallas that's a huge black actor, that's not me. You want to look for the, you know, the white guy, the old white guy, instead of the cool black.
No, I think I'm the old white guy in this situation. and by the way, I just want to point out to folks, take a good look at Keith and tell me he doesn't look like the young James T. Kirk sitting you know, in close-up on the Starship Enterprise. That's what I think. Got that kind of green tunic on, right? Anyway, Keith Dallas, great work on the book. Please give John Wells and John Morrows our regards. And thanks so much for being a guest today on Mr. Media.
Thank you for having. This is my very first FaceTime interview, so I hope I was coherent. And if I wasn't, let's, you know, make sure you do something post production or something like that.
Well, maybe I'll post a picture of you know, Christie Brinkley over your face or something.
Okay.
If it doesn't work out,
or the other Keith Dallas. Find the other Keith.
Or the other Keith Dallas. I could do that. Yeah. By the way, Keith Dallas sounds like a porn name. I just want to say.
You're not the first person to say that.
There you go. All right. Thanks very much for being on the show.
All right. Thanks, Bob.
All right. You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media Radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, the TechCrunch headlines, and the Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority, for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening. Today's episode of Mr. Media Interviews is brought to you by GoDaddy.com. You know GoDaddy.com from their wild and sexy commercials, but isn't it time you actually test drove their web hosting and domain registration services yourself? For a limited time, Mr. Media listeners can save 10% on the already low price of web hosting services at GoDaddy.com by entering the promo code POD4 at checkout. Again, that's 10% off web hosting when you go to GoDaddy.com and enter the promo code POD4, that's P-O-D, the number 4, at checkout.